So my name is Jeff Ubelt. I am the executive director of Zoo Montana.
Hello, I'm John Rossi. I'm a touring drummer with a passion for animal conservation. When I'm on the road, I spend as much time as possible visiting zoos, aquariums, and conservation organizations. Now, I want to share those places with you. I'll be talking to keepers, vets, conservationists, anyone who can help me in my mission of connecting my people to animals through their people. Join me on my raw safari. Hi, hello, hello there. Welcome back to the Raw Safari Podcast. So when I started doing Zoo News as part of this podcast, in my mind, I thought it would be really cool to occasionally be able to tie my interview episodes and my Zoo News episodes together. What I quickly came to realize is that that is quite a challenge for two reasons. First of all, I don't release Zoo News until Friday, and then the interview episode after it comes out on Tuesday, meaning that there would be a whole lot of work necessary in that time, most of which happens over the weekend when PR people aren't at zoos. And second of all, just the fact that sometimes it takes a while to connect with zoos and, you know, PR people and all of that stuff. Maybe someday when I have a fancy staff and this podcast isn't basically just me, well, we'll get there and every week could have something cool like that. But for right now, this is the first time I've really had the chance to do something like this, and I am so excited about it. So if you didn't listen to Friday's Zoo News, first of all, shame on you. I'm kidding. But what you would have missed is our lead story from the week, which was the top 10 zoos in the country, according to USA Today. And the part that really popped on that story for me was Zoo Montana coming in at number 10. And as I read some of the press about that happening for Zoo Montana, I quickly came to realize that there was a bigger story there because Zoo Montana was not accredited and was very close to closing when the current director, Jeff Ewelt, stepped in a little over a decade ago. And he really managed to turn things around with the staff there and with the help of some amazing people. And so when I read the story, I thought it was very cool. I threw it at the top of Zoo News. And then I thought, you know, this is the director of a small zoo. Let me shoot him an email. Let me see if we could get Jeff on the podcast to tell me about it. And I did. And he responded and was like, cool, want to talk tomorrow? And I was like, I do. I do want to talk tomorrow. And so we did the interview, and now you're going to get to hear it. And I'm pretty excited about that. It's really cool. Apologies to people who I have interviewed that are waiting for your episodes to come out, but I wanted to rush this one out since this is like hot zoo news right now. Hot zoo news. Maybe I should have named my podcast. Anyway, and so yeah, here it is. This is my interview with Jeff Ewelt. We're going to talk about his career getting to Zoo Montana, the changes that he and the people there made at the zoo, and how they have not only managed to become an incredible facility in a relatively short amount of time, but also how they managed to get enough votes to make the top 10 on the USA Today list, despite the fact that the population in Billings, Montana is not exactly what you would call huge. And don't worry, we do talk animals. Very specifically, we're going to talk about red pandas. I know you're shocked. But honestly, the thing that really stood out to me in this one is our conversation about the wolverines and wolverine breeding that happens at Zoo Montana. It's a really cool, really fun episode. And I hope y'all enjoy this as much as I enjoyed recording it. Real quick, just a friendly reminder to make sure you hit subscribe. Make sure you're following Raw Safari on the socials at Raw Safari or on TikTok at Raw Safari Pod. And hey, if you'd like to support the podcast, there is a Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/Raw Safari and you can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month there. But with all of that out of the way, it is time. So let's get to my interview with Jeff Ewelt of Zoo Montana.
We're an adorable little zoo in Billings, Montana.
Awesome. Yes. And I have actually been to Billings a couple of times. Oh. I haven't been able to get to the zoo yet, but I'm a touring musician and I've played Billings a couple different times now.
Oh, fantastic.
Great little town. Very little, but great.
It is. And I'll tell you what, we have one of the best music scenes I've seen. Our music scene here is spectacular. So no surprise you were here playing.
Yeah, that actually, I remember when I first like would get my schedule and see, you know, some of the places we go, I'm like, are there people? Do they know what music is?
It turns out, believe it or not.
Good. Yeah. I like it. So we are here specifically to talk about the changes that you've brought to Zoo Montana in your tenure there. You've gotten some really great press recently, and I kind of wanted to share the story in a deeper way. But I like to start off by asking my guests, like, what got you into the zoo field? What got you into animals? What was your college like, career, all that stuff? So give me your history.
I love it. Yeah. You know, it's funny. So, you know, as a kid, my parents were always great about getting us out on hikes and seeing nature and especially pointing out birds of prey. My dad was always a bird of prey lover. And so I kind of was always instilled with animals as a kid, like a lot of us in the business were. But I'll never forget the moment I knew what I wanted to do. I was shadowing a gentleman for a school project in middle school. I was in the sixth grade and I was at a little science center in Cleveland, Ohio, which is my hometown. And at the end of the day, I was a little disappointed because I didn't think working with animals was what I wanted to do anymore. He had us cutting up mice and we're doing some gross stuff. And, you know, as a little kid, I was like, okay, maybe this isn't what I wanted to do. Well, at the end of the day, when it was all done and said, he took us into a back room and said, hey, I've got one more thing I want you to do. And he opened this door and behind this door was this little tiny saw-wet owl. And he put that owl on my hand. And when that owl hit my hand, I remember clear as day, something in me changed. And now as an adult, I know my passion was being born right there in that moment. And that owl hit my hand. And I said to myself, this is it. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life. I want to somehow have an owl in my hand and I want to go and talk to people about this animal. And so fast forward, I went to school. I went to Ohio State University, the Ohio State University, as I say. And when I was there, I got a job at the Columbus Zoo. But here's the thing, is I started off working with hot dogs and Pepsi. I sold food in the concession stand just to get my foot in the door. It's the only thing I could get. And as many of us in the animal field know, you don't just walk right into an animal position. You know, being young and naive, I thought I could, but it's not the case. So I got a job working through the concession stand. And at the same time, I was volunteering at a little local wildlife rehab center in Columbus, starting to get some of my animal experience. And finally, after about 2 years of working in the concession stand, I got a job working with animals. It was in the barn, working with goats and horses, not what I wanted to work with, but I was happy that it was animals. And then a year later, finally got a job working with the birds of prey in the shows department, the animal ambassador department. And I thought I had hit the jackpot. You know, I was doing exactly what it is I wanted to do. And I was happy as could be working with birds. And it was an amazing experience.
That's awesome. I love the Columbus Zoo so much. I am a member and get there, you know, a couple times a year. It's about 5 hours from where I live right now. And it is worth the trek.
It really is.
Would this have been when Vouter was still at the Columbus Zoo and doing
Yes, I do know Vouter. I don't know him well. So, you know, he was with my time there. He was really with Natural Encounters with Steve Martin. He was with, you know, most of my career in Florida. So I knew him more from there than I did Columbus days.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Both Vouter and Steve have been on the pod and we love Natural Encounters a lot. So
absolutely.
That's very cool. Yeah. All right. So, you know, what I'm curious. So ambassador animals, you're working with birds of prey like you wanted to, but there's a ton of different taxa there. Did anything surprise you or did you become more passionate about other animals or were you always focused on the birds like internally?
Yeah, great question. I was always focused on the birds, honestly, you know, and vultures in particular. So I never, you know, when I was young and kind of gotten started in the field, I was just like, you know, hawks, eagles, all cool. I had no idea the impact of vultures would have on me. And, you know, we had the great, amazing opportunity to work with some amazing vultures, including an Andean condor by the name of Keto. And he stole my heart, you know, and so I just got this love for vultures that I never expected to get. And then at the Columbus Zoo, other than that, reptiles, reptiles. You know, I never knew that reptiles were going to be something I was so passionate about. But after working with them, and I think what I ended up finding out is that I loved being a champion for the underdogs of the animal world. And so, you know, those animals that people always, you know, kind of cringe at, your insects and your vultures, of course, and the reptiles. I just found myself really enjoying the educational piece of letting people know about these animals that, you know, they might not like, but they are so important to have, obviously, on our planet.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. That's been my experience with the podcast too, as I've gotten to meet, you know, hundreds of different species and stuff. There were ones that I liked and ones that I didn't. And now there's literally not an animal that I don't love because, you know, when you hold a scorpion, it's amazing. I used to be afraid of spiders, and now I've handled multiple tarantulas and I love them. They're amazing animals. And
yeah, that's the amazing thing. And they really do all have their little personalities, and, you know, and then I think obviously the important piece, they all have their place, you know, and that's what I think is so amazing is that everything is as cheesy as the circle of life sounds, it's real, right? And it's just amazing how every species has their place in this environment. And I'll tell you, that's I think my biggest takeaway in my career is that every animal has a purpose, from the smallest flea, you know, to the biggest megafauna out there.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so where did you go after Columbus?
Yeah, so I was at Columbus, and I graduated from Ohio State, and I knew I kind of at the time I saw opportunities elsewhere. We weren't sure if we wanted to stay in Columbus our whole life. I had a girlfriend at the time, and so we decided. I put a couple applications out, and I had an opportunity to go to Alaska or to Florida. And for whatever reason, at the time we chose Florida. I don't know why. And so I went down to Tampa's Lowry Park Zoo. Now Zoo Tampa. And I worked there as what we were called the animal ambassador manager. So still doing bird shows, but then also doing the outreach programs for the education department as well. And that job just seemed enticing to me. I had always vacationed in Florida with my family when I was a kid. And so Florida had an allure to me that, we live in Florida. And so went down there and was in Florida for 10 years and really got inept at doing a lot of media work for them, which I found I really loved. Never knew that I wanted to do that. I'm an introverted person, which is interesting, but you put a camera in front of me and I change, you know, like a lot of people do. So I really enjoyed my time in Florida. And then we had a son, my wife and I, my girlfriend that moved down with me became my wife. And we were bird trainers together at the Columbus Zoo. We got married in Florida, had a son. And after we had our son, we decided that Florida wasn't where we wanted to raise him. Schools weren't the best. We found that we weren't real keen on the heat in the summertime. And so we decided to take our chances and go to Montana sight unseen. Now, with that said, I had taken a little job as a director, my first directing job, at a little sanctuary in a tiny mountain town called Red Lodge. And so we moved to Montana, and I give credit to my wife because my son was 6 months old at the time, and wow, she had never been to Montana, and I moved her out here, and she lived in the rurals of a 20 acre property, with not knowing anybody. And she was a champion to it. And so I started directing that facility and was there for 3 years. And then that's when Zoo Montana came a calling, which is a story within itself.
Oh, yeah. And we'll get to that. But I have to point out that having two bird trainers as parents, you must have the most well-behaved son in the world.
I love that you recognize that, because I always tell people animal trainers have the best sleeping kids, because as brutal as it sounds to the outside world, you get it. I mean, you treat your kid almost like an animal, but they're sleeping. And if you train them, you know, that through opera conditioning, that crying is going to get them attention. It's going to get them attention, right? So if you just kind of ignore that negative behavior, it's amazing. We had the best sleeping baby, and I credit training for that.
That's awesome. I will say, so I came, you know, to the animal world very late, but training is something that I've just fallen in love with. And it has completely revolutionized the relationship with my son. He's 9 years old now. We have the best relationship, and it often goes against, kind of like you're saying, every like instinct you have to like calm down and let a thing happen and not, you know, go into positive punishment or negative punishment or whatever. But operant conditioning works really well, and we have this amazing relationship because of it.
I love that. And it's so true. And it really does work. That's phenomenal. Great story.
Yeah. So, all right. It's time to talk about Zoo Montana. So you said it was a story when they came calling. And, you know, the people who listen to this podcast are big fans of zoos. They're going to love the story that we're sharing. But part of that is I need you to be completely honest with me about, like, what you walked into, you know? So go ahead and tell me how you got to Zoo Montana.
Yeah, so I was in Red Lodge, as I said, this little town about 40 miles from Billings. And obviously, you know, we would get a lot of the Billings press, as you can imagine. And Zoo Montana started having some problems. And the press was picking up on this, that there were some financial issues and there were some issues with animals, you know, leaving the zoo and what have you. And I remember thinking to myself, and I remember actually talking to my wife and saying to her, I'd like to try my hand at Zoo Montana, not knowing anything about the organization or who the director was at the time. And so I contacted the board of directors and the president of the board. And I said, hey, here's my story. Here's who I am. I want to come up and kind of chat with you a little bit. And so it was very bizarre. We had it was almost like a back alley meeting. Not going to lie. It was at a bar here at Billings. I met with the board president and the VP, and we met over a drink, and we started talking about, you know, kind of what my ideas and plans were for the zoo. And they had, you know, were very open with me and said, that's great that, you know, the director that's here, we're going to ask for a resignation. And I'll get into why I think the zoo got into the problems it did. But I said, okay, great. And so next thing I know, they're calling me back and saying, hey, we want to give you a shot. And at that point I'm thinking, holy crap, what did I get myself into? And so what I agreed to do is I agreed to consult with them. And mind you, this was a big leap for me because I was new to the directing world. I was directing this tiny little place, you know, but I felt like I needed to take a chance. And I think that's the biggest piece I like to tell people is take risks. You know, the worst that would have happened is I would have failed and I would have moved on, right? I mean, nobody would have died. You know, nothing would have happened. So I just felt like this is my time. This is my time to take a risk and see what I can do. So long story short, I ended up consulting with them for 3 months, and I worked at both facilities. So I essentially was directing both facilities. And after about 3 months, we started having a little bit of success, a very minor success. And I decided that I wanted to take my hand at this full time. So I left the Nature Center, the little sanctuary, and I came up to Zoo Montana full time. Now, back up a little bit. I will never forget the first day. So the first day I took the director role as a full-time director of Zoo Montana, we lost accreditation the day before that. I'm not making this up. The day before. Mind you, my whole career goal was to direct an accredited facility. And so I'm thinking, yeah, here I go. We lose it the day before. So amazing. my first day I walk in, I have the media storm of losing accreditation. And then when we lost accreditation, then that's when other zoos, and no fault to them, started pulling their animals because we were having financial issues. It looked like we were going to close down. So, you know, these bigger zoos, they didn't trust us to have their animals. And I get that. No foul on them. And so it was a media frenzy, to say the least. Add to that, we had no idea how to run the cash registers. We were finding money just kind of strewn about the zoo. I will never forget, I opened the glove box of one of our fleet vehicles and found a $15,000 check. I mean, there were just terrible things going on here that should not have happened. But there was one thing that motivated me, and that's the day that we opened up, we had a group of school kids that arrived, and the school bus came to a stop. The kids got off the bus, and they were screaming with excitement that they were coming to the zoo. They could care less about all of the drama that was happening behind the scenes. They just wanted to enjoy the zoo, and I'll never forget that moment, and I thought to myself, that is why we're here, is to save this place for those kids so they have a place to be excited about and come to, and that motivated me. And so at that point, I said, I got to get my head down and I got to get to work. And so fast forward a little bit, what we needed to do was we had to get the public backed into our good graces. And unfortunately, I think what happened is the zoo lost its way in terms of obviously we are all about conservation in our world, right? Conservation is everything that we stand for. However, what a lot of people tend to forget is we also have to be entertaining. And that E word can sometimes be scary for a zoo to talk about. And I understand why, but there has to be something to catch the typical individual to get into the zoo and to have fun, right? So I really understood that concept and I was not afraid of that entertaining word. And I remember going to our local television stations. We only have two big ones here in Billings. And I said, let me come on air with some animals. Let me have some fun. Let's make the news anchor scream because I need to get my audience back. I need them to know that we're open, we're going strong, and we're moving towards where we need to be. And the CBS station said, we'd love to have you on. Let's see what happens and let's go. Sure enough, had fun TV. People loved it. They loved seeing the animals. They loved learning. And that got some excitement building. And as that excitement built, we were working behind the scenes on getting the staff morale back where it needed and then slowly getting the trust back of our donors, right? And so the problem that the zoo had in the past is that they would get a great donor in, say they'd get a $50,000 gift to upgrade the otter habitat. They wouldn't use it for the otter habitat. They used it to keep the light bulbs on. And so we lost the trust of all of our donors. And so nobody saw their work, their money being put to work. And so we had a particular donor that was the sponsor of our otter habitat. And I remember meeting with him and it wasn't the best meeting. He was not happy. But I said, I'm a different person. I said, give me a shot. Let me have your dollars. You're going to see where we put that money. And hopefully then you can bump elbows with those that you need to bump, those friends that are wealthy, blah, blah, blah. And we did that. And so as hard as it was to make sure that we were covering payroll, I made sure we made those upgrades to that outer habitat to prove ourselves. And so we did that. And so we started getting the graces of our donors back. And then I made a very bold prediction to one of our local magazines of five things we wanted to complete in the next 5 years. And after 5 years are up, we completed every one of those five predictions. And that, I think, caught the interest of a lot of people. And fast forward now, 12 years later, we were $400,000 on the hole when we started. We've been in the black for the last seven of those 12 years. We regained AZA accreditation in 2019. We waited 8 years to do it. And the reason we waited so long is because we wanted to make sure our ducks were in a row. We have incredible sponsors now. We've done 18 major exhibits in those 12 years. And we're back on the map. And then just last week, we were named one of the top 20 zoos in the country. And through voting, we ended up being one of the top 10. So it still boggles my mind that we've made it as far as we had in 12 years. But it has been a journey. It's been a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And it's been difficult. But we've done it because we believed in what this organization can be. We had the passion. We had the staff, the incredible, incredible staff. You know, my face gets the credit for this. But I would be nowhere if it wasn't for my incredible staff and volunteers getting us to the point that we're at. It's just amazing.
That is incredible. And yeah, I have to admit, on my podcast over the last couple of years, I've been very cynical about the USA Today rankings just because, of course.
I get it.
When I read your story, even though I can be very cynical about it, I was like, holy cow, this is amazing. And so maybe the cynicism is, a little warranted and a little not all at once because
and but I absolutely understand that idea. You know, I kind of am too. Sometimes, you know, they just call random zoos. Hey, do you want to be on the list? And for us, it's for the public that has been behind us. And one thing that Billings does well is they come through when it's time to vote. And we have done some amazing things through the power of voting here at Zoo Montana. We won a Toyota Prius in a national contest. I mean, so Billings, Montana knows how to vote. And so for us, you know, being on that top 20 list was great, but yes, kind of in the same idea as you, I was like, okay, did they just pick us because they heard about what's the story there? But to be able to beat out some of those big metropolitan areas, you know, in Little Billings, Montana, and be the smallest zoo on that list was amazing.
Yeah,
and for
that's
us,
what popped for me was the fact that the people voted, like getting on the list, having the so-called experts pick you guys. Cool. Like you said, you don't know what's going to happen. Why were you one of the top 20 when the Columbus Zoo wasn't? Like, right, come on, Columbus is great, right? We've talked about that.
Of course, I agree.
But then to get the votes, that's what actually really caught my attention and made me start doing some digging for other stuff about y'all. Because I've heard of Zoo Montana just because I do this, but I've not, like, heard of Zoo Montana, you know?
Sure.
And wow, what an incredible story. You know, I'm really impressed. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been a story. And like I said, it's been a journey to say the least, but you know, we've got a great dedicated staff. We still have two of our staff members that were here during that time when it was so, you know, kind of in turmoil, and they stuck it through. And so to watch them and know what they've seen and to see the successes that we've had, that's the best part for me, is to watch them and see them kind of be proud of what they helped build. It was just amazing, you know, and again, I hate that I'm the one that gets the attention just because I'm the one that's in the front of the cameras, but I'd be nowhere if it wasn't for the incredible staff that we have.
Yeah, no, I really mean that's awesome. I can tell that you do. And, you know, hopefully once things have settled down here a little bit, we'll do another interview and maybe chat with one of your staff members or something. Because a lot of times I like to talk to keepers and stuff rather than like the face of the place. You know?
Right. So. I understand that. You betcha.
But yeah, so let's dive a little bit deeper into some of the changes that you made. You said that you made like five promises that you were going to come through on. So what were those and what was that process like for you?
Yeah. So the biggest one was accreditation, of course, you know, and, you know, we took a little longer on accreditation than I think we probably wanted to. But again, it was one of those things where I wanted to make sure our ducks were in a row. And before we took that leap, and we just had to take the leap of faith, right? We were at the point where we felt like, okay, what more can we do? Probably not much. We just have to try and see where we're at. And so that was the biggest, I think, promise to the community. The second one is that your dollars are going to be put where they say they're going to be put. And so if we get a gift in that's for our bear habitat or for a new, for example, we just built a new waterfowl refuge. If you donate to that, you better believe that you're going to be transparent. We're going to show you where that dollar is being spent. So that transparency was a huge part of it. Letting people see our books, knowing exactly where our dollars are being spent and what they're being spent on. That was a huge one. Getting out in the schools more, obviously, you know, strengthening our education program was a no-brainer. I mean, that's just common sense. That was a big one too. You're going to see us out in the community a lot more. That was the other one. And then I'm trying to think what the last one was. I don't even remember anymore. But just basically that we were going to be a community player, a community asset. We were going to be a community gathering place. It was really important for us. So we are one of the few zoos that don't get public support. So there's no tax dollars coming our way, private, which, you know, there are other ones out there. And so it was our goal that we knew we had to diversify our income. And so becoming a community gathering place, which most zoos are, but we wanted to make sure that we were not afraid to say no to some of the more bizarre, you know, requests that would come in to rent our facility. So we've had fights here. We have concerts here, like a lot of facilities do. We do a big wedding business. We do obviously company picnics. So just diversifying our income was a huge piece of our success. Honestly, I think that's where our biggest successes were. It was not being afraid to be a venue for the community and then giving back to the community, right? We're out there with our hand out as a nonprofit, but we understand that we have a responsibility to be a community steward. And so we easily give, you know, and for us, our budget's only what, $2.4 million now. So we give back over $40,000 in passes to other nonprofits to ensure those nonprofits can raise money on their own using us as a tool. I'm trying to do as many free programmings that we can. You know, so they're definitely giving back to the community was a big part of our success in becoming that community player. So unless you live under a rock, you know Zoo Montana's here. We are loud. We're proud of that. It's just something that we're not afraid to stand up to some more risky ventures as well. Our stance on wolf is very public. That's been dangerous. We've gotten death threats before. Wolves in Montana don't mix. We're not afraid to be pro-wolf. We've done a couple risky pride events here that has gotten us a little bit of a bad press, which I will not waver on that whatsoever. We are for everybody. So we're not afraid to take kind of some stances. And I'll be honest, for little Zoo Montana, we've garnered some crazy national news in those 12 years, which always amazes me that little Zoo Montana can make such a national outreach. I love that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that is wonderful. And I just think it's so cool to see how quickly, because zoos move at a glacial pace. And so honestly, when you're talking about, you know, 12 years, especially your first year or two in there, I'm sure you were just treading water. It's amazing to hear this. That's insane. Go ahead.
I got to tell you one story that I love to tell. I wasn't comfortable telling this for years because I never wanted to get in trouble with the state of Montana, but it's passed and they know about it. So the first major new habitat that we built was what we call a living wall, which is in our main building. And it's basically our ambassador animals, but in really cool kind of artistic habitats. And when we built that, we got a grant from the state of Montana. And I'll never forget, it was my second payroll when I was there. I didn't have the money in the bank to cover payroll. And I was thinking I was going to have to put this payroll on credit card, which is like, what? And so a day before payroll came due, we got that state grant and the money hit our bank account. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, I can pay payroll. So I used that grant funding to pay payroll. But that said, I was always mindful that we have to build this animal habitats education wall, right? Because that's what the money's for. And we did. We scraped together enough funding to get that animal wall built and essentially use that funding where it needed to be used. But there were times that we had to really get creative with our money to figure out how we were going to get Nick to the next step. Those were crazy days.
Yeah. Wow. That's impressive. Now, I do have a question about that, though. How did your staff feel knowing that, like, they might not get paid, or maybe they just trusted that you'd figure it out, but that you're building a living wall or building up your otter habitat or something? How did they feel?
That's a key. I never let them know. It's my job to worry about that. As a director, I feel like I really believe, subscribe to the idea the buck stops at my desk. And so I felt like that my, especially my caregivers at the time, you know, a lot of them were here, obviously, when things were bad. The last thing they needed to worry about was where their paycheck was coming from. I just had to keep that optimistic attitude that paycheck was coming, even though I had sleepless nights. But that's what I signed up for. So I never let them know. I never wanted them to know. I would let them know that, hey, we're going to tighten the reins a little bit on the budget, but I would never let them know that their paycheck was in danger. Just one less stress they had to worry about. Their job was being out there, you know, taking care of those animals, taking care of our education programs, doing all the amazing things that moved us forward. It was my job to worry about the money. So they never knew how dire it was.
All right. I love that. Now, what did you do for your mental health to make sure you didn't lose your mind during that time?
I had a few teary nights. I'm not going to lie. My wife was my backbone. I mean, she was just there. I had a great board of directors at the time that was wonderful at, you know, kind of hearing me out, to just kind of hearing my ideas. But I'll be quite frank with you. I am optimistic, maybe to a fault. So failure was never really an option in my head, even though it was there all the time. Yes, I had sleepless nights wondering about money, but what I've learned in my last 12 years as a director is if there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, as bad as things can get, there will always be a solution out there. You just might have to create or define that solution. So, you know, how did I get over it? Leaving and spending the weekend with my family. That was huge for me. I was really good at the time at turning things off. I'm not the best at it, but I was decent enough where I could at least turn it off, enjoy my family. Thank God I had a kid that was growing up. He was, you know, it was at a great time where he obviously wanted and needed my attention. So thank God I had that. That's what got me through.
That's awesome.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is. That's honestly a beautiful, beautiful story. And honestly, all of this has been a beautiful story, but oh my gosh, you're at a zoo and we haven't talked about animals. And I don't want to get yelled at by my fans. So would you be willing to tell me a little bit about some of the animals that you have there and kind of that make, you know, Zoo Montana special?
Yeah, so we only, the outdoor animals, we only feature animals on the 45th parallel. So what I always tell kids, you put your finger on Montana, you spin the globe, anything on or above that line, that's where our animals come from. And we do that for two reasons. Number one is budget. I'd love to build a, you know, 20,000 square foot rainforest here at the zoo, but I have to be mindful of what I can afford. If I had $1 million check come from the city every year, I'd think about that, but I don't. And so unfortunately, I have to be mindful that I can afford what I build. So that's number one. But number two, two, by having animals on that parallel, we can keep our animals outdoors 99% of the time. And that's important for us. You know, a giraffe in Montana is going to have to live inside for 3 to 4 months out of the year. It just doesn't fit what we want and what we believe in. We want those animals to be outside a lot. So those are the northern tier animals. The exception to that rule is our education animals. So they do live indoors, but they travel with us. They do get out quite a bit. And we did just build a, what we call the super duper animal playground, an outdoor area that we can take our animals outdoors for that. But we feature about 50-50 in terms of exotic versus native. And so we do, of course, have your typical native wildlife, grizzly bears. We have bison, otter, river otters, birds of prey, of course, lynx and wolves. And then the exotic side, we do have a moor tigers. We have red pandas, of course, takin, which are pretty neat. And I think the ones that we're most proud of are wolverines. We have a really robust wolverine program here. We were successful last year with kits. We were successful again this year with kits. And we're proud of that because breeding of wolverines in the U.S. has not been successful. And so we're excited to be able to contribute to that population. So pretty exciting things there. So, but we're small. We're 70 acres. So size-wise, we're big. But we utilize maybe only 30% of those 70 acres, only about 100 animals of 56, 58 species. And so we are tiny. And I think that's probably our biggest challenge is that when people do visit from bigger cities, they come to our zoo, they don't quite understand what we are and what we stand for. And so they're expecting to see your big boys, you know, your San Diego's and your Columbus. And we're not that. And we never want to be that. We want to be very mindful of our growth. And we want you to come and feel like you're being immersed in nature. And then you get a bonus of seeing a grizzly bear, or a wolverine or what have you. We take a lot of pride in our grounds. We've got 9 beautiful botanical gardens. We're an accredited arboretum as well. And so we really want folks to kind of be immersed in nature. So a little different than a typical zoo setting. You know, we really want that nature component to take over. We got a beautiful creek that runs through the grounds. And so it's a different type of place, almost maybe more nature center than zoo, if there is a difference. I don't know. And so that's kind of what I think sets us apart a little bit.
No, that's awesome. And, everybody who's listening right now is going, oh, gosh, John's going to jump in and talk red pandas because they're his favorite. But we're not. We are going to. But first, I want to talk wolverines. I love wolverines. And I have not had the chance to talk to anyone about wolverines on the podcast yet. And like you said, I know I've been talking about the fact on my Zoo News episodes that y'all are breeding wolverines at a unprecedented success in the area. So what can you just kind of describe wolverines to my listeners who might not have seen them? And then also talk about why you think you're having such success?
Yeah, so wolverines are incredible animals. They are they're such an elusive animal. There's just not a lot of data out about them. I mean, they're just wild. And so we have 2 at the zoo, well, 3 now because of our kit. So they're the largest land-dwelling mustelids. So related to your otters and your minks and your weasels and what have you. The biggest mustelid, of course, is sea otter, but this is the largest land-dwelling one, about 38 to 30. 40-ish pounds. So think of us, maybe a small dog size. But these animals can take down a sick or injured elk by themselves. I mean, they are just a tenacious animal. They've got a patience you wouldn't believe and an energy like I've never seen of any other animal. You know, in the wild, a wolverine will literally bound for 16 hours a day. They just have an unlimited amount of energy. So kind of think almost like a Tasmanian devil on steroids, if they're is such a thing. I mean, that's wild to think about. But what I love about them is that they've got this specialized tooth that's rotated in their mouth about 180 degrees that allows them to munch on frozen food. So up in the high elevation mountains where they're found, they may come across a dead carcass and be able to eat that dead carcass, whether it's frozen or not. So pretty amazing. They are primarily scavengers. I mean, they are incredible hunters when they need to be, but they really do scavenge most of the food that they eat. Now, the 2 that we have are part of a European breeding program, which is now an American program, but we brought them over from Sweden and Norway, and they came here to the zoo. And why have we had success? It's a simple concept that I really believe in. We leave them alone. We let them be. wolverines. And I think sometimes some of the bigger zoos, and again, I've been part of it, and this is no ill will by any means, but they want to get their hands on the babies, right? They want to get blood. They want to, you know, do all these things, which absolutely you need to do. But we don't. We take a hands-off approach. We let them do what they do. When mom has the babies, we stand back. We monitor. We make sure everything's looking okay. But we let her be a mom. She knows what to do best. And so let's let her do that. And so when babies are born, they're amazing. They're born white to blend in with the snow. They get their color within a couple months. And by a year's time, they're going to be full grown. So this year is our third kit that we've had. It's the second year that they've bred. And so last year they had two. This year they had one. Why they only had one and not three, we don't know. But I will say that this one is a chunk. And so we certainly know it took most of mom's resources. But they are a strikingly amazing animal. We just love them. And our caregivers have done such an amazing job with training of them that a lot of times if we have folks, you know, visiting from other institutions, we can take them in with the wolverines and do training sessions with them in the habitat. They're that good. They are just incredible animals.
And now all I want to do is come and do a training session with wolverines. That's amazing to me.
We can make that happen.
That's awesome. Wow, I'm really blown away by that. Yeah, I've always compared them. It's funny because I've liked wolverines for a while. I have a friend who's kind of obsessed with them. And I've always compared them to like a mixture of tazzies and honey badgers.
And, exactly right.
And I think it's so amazing that people are obsessed with the Tasmanian devils, like in the United States, and rightly so. They're an amazing animal, but then don't know what wolverines are or like how similar they are. They even walk the same way. I call it a lope. I don't know if that's the right word, but they just kind of lope when they move. And
they do.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, we have our own Tasmanian devil right here in the States. No, not many people know that.
Yep. And apparently they're getting reintroduced or might be getting reintroduced into Colorado soon. There's legislature, bipartisan legislature pushing for it. So I'm pretty excited about that.
I am too. And great news. And we certainly hope that's the case. And I'll tell you, I hope that that happens, that, you know, they can utilize AZA zoos for those, some of those reintroductions. Now I know they want to move them in, but if we can help with some actual reintroduction, I mean, that's what it's all about. Right. So we can only hope that something like that will happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, as I mentioned, I will be murdered because they're not just my favorite, but a lot of my listeners are big pandas. So can you tell me about your red pandas?
Yeah, so we have two. In fact, we have one, and I say this kind of jokingly, but not really. We have one of the most famous red pandas in North America
right now.
Pabu. And if you don't know Pabu, you got to Google Pabu, Prince of Pounce. You will see why he's famous. He used to pounce on his mom at the Oregon Zoo. And so Mom, Maymay, and Pabu came to Zoo Montana a couple years ago because Oregon was just a little too loud. Maymay, the mom, didn't care for loud noises, and so we're just kind of we're a really quiet zoo. We don't, you know, our attendance is not huge. And so it was the perfect place for them. So they came over to us. We still have Pabu. Maymay, the mom, has moved on. And Pabu's getting a girlfriend this year. Nice. So we're very excited about that. But he is just one of the sweetest, most laid back animals I've ever worked with. He's incredible. And then we do have another one by the name of Dooley. He's a male. And he is a little bit older. I want to say he is 12 right now. And then a couple years ago, we received a Guinness Book of World Record for the oldest living red panda currently at a zoo at that time. He passed away at the age of 22. His name was Taylor. And so that was quite a feat. And this, I'm not making this up. He got the Guinness Book of World Record and he died the day after. I can't make that up. It's the wildest story I've ever been a part of.
Wow. That's honestly astonishing. That's amazing. Yeah. Wow, yeah. Yeah. I am friends with Luna, the current oldest red panda in captivity, and I've hung out with her a couple times, and wow, ancient red pandas are really their own thing.
They really are. And oh, Taylor, we loved him to death. And he was a little old man. He acted like a little old man, but I tell you, his quality of life stayed really high until those final weeks. But he was a survivor, there's no doubt.
To go from Taylor, just the oldest old man, to Pabu must have been a heck of a transition.
It was shocking. We're like, oh my gosh, this is how red pandas actually act. Imagine that. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I'm into nerd culture, but kind of only the things that I like. And I had always avoided Avatar: The Last Airbender and the series Korra, which is where, you know, Pabu's name comes from. And it was actually learning about Pabu the Red Panda that got me to check out those shows. And now I'm obsessed and I love them. So, like, I owe Pabu because he helped me, you know?
That's great. I'll let him know next time I go down to see him.
Perfect. Thank you. I appreciate that. So awesome.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, I've really appreciated the time here. I was wondering, are there any conservation orgs that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Yeah, Red Panda Network. I love them and the work that they do. And so that's definitely one that we try to support here the most. And then, you know, there's some great programs here in the state of Montana, but that Red Panda Network is one that's near and dear to us.
Love that. Yeah, I volunteer for them. I'm a big fan as well. So yeah,
awesome.
Very cool.
Thank
and
you.
Then, yeah, of course. It's time now, don't you know? We've come to the end of the show. But there's one tale left to go. You're going to laugh and say, oh no. It's time for the Ron Safari Poop Story.
Not so much poop, but I think one of the most disgusting things was, you know, in the zoo world, we like to prank each other. And sometimes those pranks get out of hand and gross. And I had a colleague that put I think it was a trout. He hid it in my office in a drawer. Oh. And I didn't find it for weeks. And you can only imagine how horrible that smell was. I will never forgive him for that. I was very angry at him, but it was all in good fun, of course. That's probably the worst story that I've had. I've been fortunate. I haven't had too many. I mean, and everybody always wants to know what's the worst poop. For me, it's tiger poop. There's nothing that stinks as worse as tiger poop. Fortunately, I've never had any major issues with that. I will say, though, as a bird trainer, and any bird trainer that's worth birds of prey, you know this. You know, a lot of times when birds will pick out the insides of an animal, they'll you know, flip their head back and forth. And certainly, we've had our share of guts getting in our mouth, which is never pleasant.
Very fair. Very fair. I appreciate the time. And, you know, congratulations. This is such a cool success story, and I'm so glad to be able to share it in depth on the podcast. I don't know when I'm going to make it out to Montana, but like, I'm really motivated to get out there and see the facility and see this amazing place in person.
Always welcome. We'd love to have you. And thank you for letting us, giving us the platform. You know, we really, it is an amazing story here. We've got an amazing crew that made it happen, and we're proud of where we're at. So thank you for giving us the platform to tell this story.
Absolutely. I love how inspirational that conversation was. I love the conversation about Wolverines. I love the invitation to go and, you know, get to be part of a training session with them. Don't know when I'm going to be able to get back to Montana. It's kind of off the beaten path, but I've already started looking at some potential gigs that might get me kind of close because I'm a crazy person, but I'm a crazy person who loves Wolverines. So, you know, I think that's fair. I want to thank Jeff and everyone at the team at Zoo Montana for doing such an incredible, incredible job turning that facility around and making it something that all all people in Montana and the AZA community can be very, very proud of. And I also want to thank Jeff, frankly, for just hopping on so quickly. It was so fun to be able to turn this around so fast. So, I had a lot of fun with this. Zoo News dropped on Friday. I interviewed him on Friday, and I am wrapping up this episode on Saturday afternoon and getting it ready to release on Tuesday. So that was a lot of fun. I would also like to say thank you to my Red Panda level patrons, Dr. Laura Shank, Dr. Stephen Williamson, Barbara Bennett, and Jenny Owens. And then I think all I have left to say is, remember, friends, the word credits backwards is Steiderk.
The Ross Safari Podcast is produced, hosted, and engineered by John Rossi. Editing and fact-checking by John and Dr. Zoe Rossi. Our theme song is Sevens by Nathan Burke, performed by Nathan and John. Interrupting John theme and additional voices by Taylor Isaac Gray. You can reach John directly on Instagram and Facebook at Ross Safari or by email at rossafaripod@gmail.com. Ross Safari is part of the Daydreamer Media Network. Now, stop listening to me and go visit a zoo.